Sausage had been interrupted by the high-pitched yammer of Miss Izzy, who strode up with her hands folded across her chest, followed by Bum Bum and Sister G. "We've been waiting at the bench for half an hour. Where's the donuts? Did you know Soup Lopez is back?" Sausage pointed to the sign over the building entrance. "Where you been? Alaska?" Miss Izzy looked at the sign, then back at Sausage, until her gaze slipped over to Sportcoat, and she blinked in surprise. "Oh, Papi, what you doing here?"
"Nothing."
"Papi, olvidaste lo que le hiciste a ese demonio Deems. Su banda de lagartos te va a rebenar como un plantano. You got to leave, Papi."
Sister G stepped forward and said evenly to Sportcoat, "Deacon, the police came by the church asking for you."
"I'ma find that Christmas money, sister. I told the pastor I'm gonna, and I'm gonna."
"They wasn't fretting about that. They was asking about somebody named Thelonious Ellis. You know him?"
Sausage had taken a seat on the top step of the building entrance when the women arrived. From his seat on the step, Sausage looked up, stunned, and then blurted,
"What they want me for? I didn't shoot Deems."
At the mention of Deems, there was a pregnant silence. Several people standing in line to play numbers slipped away before placing their bets. The rest of the people stood in anxious silence, staring straight ahead, numbers papers in hand, edging forward, one eye in the direction of the flagpole where Deems worked, pretending not to have heard anything. This was juicy indeed. Juicy enough to risk your life over, but not juicy enough to get involved.
"I didn't know Thelonious Ellis was your name," Sister G said to Hot Sausage. "I thought you was Ralph or Ray something or other."
"What difference do it make?"
"Makes a big difference," she said, exasperated. "It makes me out to be a liar to the police."
"You can't be a liar by what you don't know," Hot Sausage said. "The Bible says Jesus had many names."
"Well, golly, Sausage, where's it say in the Bible that you're Jesus?"
"I ain't said I was Jesus. I said I ain't stuck with just one name."
"Well, how many names you got?"
Sister G demanded.
"How many do a colored man need in this world?"
Sister G rolled her eyes.
"Sausage, you never said nothing about having no other name. I thought your real name was Ray Olin."
"You mean Ralph Odom. Not Ray Olin, Ralph Odom."
"Same thing."
"It don't matter. That's not my real name, nohow. Ralph Odom's the name I gived to housing when I come on staff 24 years ago. Ellis is my real name. Thelonious Ellis."
He shook his head, pursing his lips.
"Now the police want me. What I done?"
"They don't want you, Sausage. They want the deacon here. I reckon they called your name thinking you was him."
"Well, there it is," Hot Sausage fumed at Sportcoat, sucking his teeth. "You done pulled me into the swill again, Sport."
"What are you talking about?"
Sister G asked. But Hot Sausage ignored her. Boiling, he glared at Sportcoat.
"Now the cops is hunting me, and Deems is hunting you. You happy?"
"These projects is going down," Miss Izzy exclaimed. "Everybody's hunting everybody."
She tried to sound disconsolate, but instead sounded almost happy. This was high-grade gossip, delicious, exciting. The numbers players still in line who were listening shifted lustily, edging closer to the conversation, almost gleeful, their ears wide open, waiting for the next tidbit.
"How did this happen?" Sister G asked Sausage.
"Well, I bought an old Packard back in 52. I wasn't following the Ten Commandments back in them days, sister. I had no license or papers or nothing when I come to New York on account of I hoisted a shot, a sip, and a nip of spirits from time to time in them days. I bought that car and let Sport here register the dang thing for me. Sport's good at talking to white folks. He went down to Motor Vehicles with my birth certificate and got the license and all the papers and everything. One colored looks just like another down there. So, he removed his hat and wiped his head, glancing up at Sport Coat. We keeps the license and switches off. One week he holds it, the next week I holds it. Now the cops is holding me to judgment on account of Sport Coat. Sausage barked at Sport Coat. Somebody who seen you drop Deems in the plaza must have seen you beating it to my boiler room and told the cops. Then he said to Sister G, they looking for him with my name. Why I got to be burdened with his note? Only wrong I done to him is to place a bet. What bet? Sister G asked. Sausage glanced at Joaquin in the betting window, who, along with the line of bettors, was openly staring at them. Joaquin looked chagrined, but remained silent. What difference do it make? Hot Sausage said glumly. I got bigger problems now. I'll explain it to the police, Sister G said. I'll tell them your real name. Don't do that, Sausage said quickly. I got a warrant out for me, back in Alabama. Sister G, Miss Izzy, and Sister Billing stared at each other in surprise. Joaquin and several people in line watched with interest as well. This confession was unexpected, but juicy. A warrant? Oh, that's bad luck, puppy. Joaquin piped up from his window. You good people too, bro. He said it so loudly that several people in line who had tuned out now tuned back in, staring at Hot Sausage. Sausage glanced at them and said, why ain't you just put it on the radio, Joaquin? That does change the bet, though, puppy, Joaquin said. Don't try to twist out of it. Hot Sausage sucked his teeth. I won the bet, fair and square. What bet? Sister G said. Well, Sausage began, then trailed off. To Joaquin, he said hotly, I'd sleep in a hollow log before I give you a plug nickel. Things happen, bro, Joaquin said sympathetically again. I understand, but I still want my cigar. I'd fertilize my toilet with 10 cigars before I give you one. Could a grown-up speak here? Sister G said impatiently. She turned to Sausage. What was the bet? Sausage didn't address her, but rather turned to Sport Coat, looking sheepish. Oh, it was about you, buddy. Getting pulled in, arrested, you see? I ain't mean nothing by it. I'd have bailed you out if I could. Best thing for you is to get arrested, Sport. But now I got to worry about my own skin. Hot Sausage looked away glumly, rubbing his jaw. A warrant ain't nothing, Sausage, Sport Coat said. The police gives them out all over. Rufus, over at the watch house, has got a warrant on him, too, back in South Carolina. He does? Sausage brightened immediately. For what? He stole a cat from the circus, except he wasn't no cat. It got big, whatever it was, so he shot it. Maybe it wasn't no cat he killed, Sausage snorted. Rufus ain't got no moderation. Who knows what he done? That's the thing with the warrant. You don't know what it's for. When a person got a warrant on them, they could have killed somebody. There was a pregnant silence as Miss Izzy, Bum Bum, Sister G, Joaquin, Sport Coat, and several people in line stared at Hot Sausage, who sat on the top step, fanning himself with his pork pie hat. Eventually, he noticed them staring and said, well, what y'all looking at me for? Did you? Miss Izzy asked. Izzy, keep quiet, Joaquin barked. Shut your talking hole, you evil gangster, she snapped. Go take drowning lessons, woman. Monkey? Ape? Me gustaría romperte a la mitad, pero ¿quién necesita dos de ustedes? Well, y'all quit, Sausage shouted. I ain't ashamed to tell it. I was on a work crew in Alabama and runned off. He looked at Sportcoat. So there.
That's the difference between Alabama and South Carolina, Sportcoat said proudly. In my home country, a man on a work crew stays on the work crew till the job is done. We ain't quitters in South Carolina.
Can we rope this in and get to the problem? Sister G said, her voice sharp. She turned to Sportcoat. Deacon, you're going to have to go to the police. Deems was a wonderful boy, but the devil's having his way with him right now. You can explain that to the police.
I ain't explaining nothing. I done him no wrong that I recall, Sportcoat said.
You don't remember humping Deems like a dog when you shot him? Miss Izzy said. I heard that, too. A woman in line at Joaquin's window said to the man behind her. I was right there, Miss Izzy said proudly. He showed Deems who's boss.
The woman laughed and turned to Sportcoat.
Ooh-wee! You a bad man, Mr. Sportcoat. Oh, well, better to be a fat man in a graveyard than a thin man in a stew.
What's that mean? Sportcoat asked.
Means Deems is gonna come meddling, and you best not be around, Hot Sausage said.
Deems ain't gonna do nothing, Sportcoat said. I known him all his life.
It's not just him, Sister G said. It's the folks he works for. I hear tell they're worse than a bunch of root doctors.
Sportcoat waved his hand dismissively. I ain't come here to sit around talking all this who shot John nonsense. I come here, he said, glaring at Hot Sausage, to talk to a certain boiler man about my umpire suit, which I put up in his boiler room.
Well, since we is on the subject of taking back things, where's my driver's license with your picture on it using my name?
Hot Sausage asked.
What you need that for? Sportcoat said. You's in trouble enough. Plus, it's my week to hold it.
It ain't my fault that your past is bad. Sausage held out his hand. I'll take it now, please. You won't be needing it nohow.
Sportcoat shrugged and pulled out a weathered wallet, thick with papers, and from it produced the license, frayed around the edges, and handed it over.
Now give me my umpire stuff so I can start up the game again. I'ma get these kids round here on the right track again.
Is your cheese done slid off your cracker, Sport? These kids don't want no baseball. Them days ended the minute Deems walked off the team.
He ain't walk off, Sportcoat said. I throwed him off for smoking them funny reefer cigarettes.
Sport, you is more out of date than a Philadelphia nightclub. I know bartenders from Hong Kong smarter than you. These children want tennis shoes now, and dungaree jackets, and dope. They whooping ass and robbing old folks to get it. Half of your baseball team works for Deems now.
Soup don't work for him, Sportcoat said proudly.
That's 'cause Soup was a guest of the state, Joaquin said from his window. Give him time. You need to go, bro, just till things cool off. You can go stay with my cousin Elena in the Bronx if you want. She's never home. She got a good job working for the railroad. Miss Izzy snorted. She's been boarded more times than the railroad, too. Don't stay there, Sport. You'll get fleas, or worse.
Joaquin's face reddened.
Tienes una mente de una pista. Una sucia, sucia.
So does your mother, Miss Izzy said.
All right already, Sister G said, glancing around. The line of people waiting to play their numbers had quit, and most had taken seats on the stoop near Sausage to watch this theater, which was better than any numbers game.
Sister G said, Let's think this through. And as she spoke, the sound of the front door opening behind them was heard, and she looked up over their shoulders, gaping in surprise. The rest followed her shocked gaze, glancing over their shoulders to a sight that brought them to their feet. Standing behind them, Soup Lopez,
a resplendent, smiling giant in a crisp gray suit, white shirt, and splendid black bow tie. All 6'10" of him stood on the top step, filling the open doorway of Building 17.
Soup! Soup Lopez! Back from the dead! Sopa! Comprame una bebida! ¿De dónde sacaste este traje? Oh, my lass! Soup roared.
Cries of greeting and handshakes all around as the crowd surrounded the big man who towered over them. Joaquin, from his window, poured several quick whiskey shots into plastic cups, then abandoned the window altogether, emerging from the building with his guitar, followed by the bongo player of Los Soñadores, who hurriedly rushed out the building entranceway, shouting in Spanish, "Nephew!" and hugged Soup, who lifted the small man like he was a pillow. Los Soñadores quickly plugged in, and the horrible music began again, with even more gusto than before. For the next hour and a half, Sport Coat's crisis was forgotten. It was still early, and Soup greeted all his old friends by amusing everyone with magic tricks. He picked up two women in one hand. He showed everybody one-handed push-ups he'd learned in prison. He showed off his shoes, size 18s, special made by the state of New York, and impressed his old coach, Sport Coat, by taking off one shoe and using it to squat a handball 300 yards.
"You always said I had good basics," he said proudly.
The joy encouraged a frolic, and several who were embarrassed to approach Sport Coat now came forward to shake his hand, pat him on the back, thank him for shooting Deems, and offer him drinks. One old grandmother gave him the $2 she normally used to play the numbers, stuffing the money in his coat pocket. A young mother stepped forward and said,
"You showed me how to can peaches,"
and kissed him. A thick-bodied transit authority worker named Calvin, who manned the toll booth at the local G-Train subway stop, ambled up, shook Sport Coat's hand, and slipped $5 into Sport Coat's pocket, saying,
"My man!"
The floodgates were open, and the crowd of onlookers who had fled when they first spotted him wandered back to marvel that he was still alive, gawk at him, and shake his hand.
"Go on, old-timer. Sport Coat, you showed him. Sport, eres audaz. Estás caliente, baby, but eres el culo.
Sport Coat, come bless my son," a young pregnant mother shouted, her hands on her rounded stomach. Sport Coat endured it all with a blend of awe, bashfulness, and pride, shaking hands and enjoying free drinks that were poured for him from Joaquin's window, paid for by his neighbors, the window now manned by Miss Izzy, who apparently knew enough about her ex-husband to know he didn't give a hoot who poured the hooch so long as the 50 cents per shot was collected. Unbeknownst to him, she kept a quarter from each pour for herself. Handling charges. The rush at Sport Coat was merry until Dominic Lafleur, the Haitian sensation and Sport Coat's neighbor in Building 9, appeared with his friend Mingo, a horrid-looking old man with a pitted, pimply face. In his hand was a horrible-looking homemade doll which consisted of three tiny couch pillows stuck together with a head that looked and felt suspiciously like four size D batteries taped together covered by cloth. Dominic slapped Sport Coat on the back, held the doll out to him, and said, "You are now protected." Bum Bum, who had faithfully stood in line 20 minutes to play her number, and who had lost her place twice since the party started and the line had been reduced to a line for whiskey shots, took umbrage.
"Why are you spreading haints and spirits, Dominic?"
"It's good luck," Dominic said.
"He don't need luck. He got Jesus. He can have this too. Jesus Christ don't need no witchery. Jesus don't need no ugly dolls. Jesus ain't got no limits. Look at Soup. Jesus brought him home 'cause we was praying for him. Ain't that right, Soup?"
Soup, in his suit and bow tie, towering over the party of folks drinking shots and a few now dancing to the horrific bachata of Los Soñadores, looked uncomfortable.
Truth is, sister, I don't go to church no more. I'm a member of the nation.
What nation?
The Nation of Islam.
Is that like the United Nations?
Bum Bum asked.
No, really, he said. They got their own flag, like the Stars and Stripes?
Sausage asked.
Them Stars and Stripes ain't mine, Brother Sausage, Soup said. I got no country. I'm a citizen of the world, a Muslim.
Oh, Hot Sausage said, uncertain what else to say.
See, Muhammad was the true prophet of God, not Jesus. And Muhammad didn't use no little dolls like Dominic here.
Seeing the horror on Bum Bum's face, Soup added,
but I agrees with you to a point, Miss Bum Bum. Everybody needs something.
He was trying to be amenable, as Soup always was, but his words had a terrible effect. Bum Bum stood with her hands on her hips, thunderstruck into silence. Dominic looked away in embarrassment. Sister G, Hot Sausage, and Sport Coat couldn't believe what they'd heard. Joaquin, noting a lull in the activity among them, unslung his guitar, slipped into the front door of the building as Los Soñadores chugged on, and emerged a minute later with a bottle of brandy.
Welcome back, Soup. I saved this for you, Joaquin said.
Soup took the bottle in his giant hand.
I can't drink this, he said. This is the white man's way of keeping the black man down.
With Dominican brandy, Joaquin said. That's the best.
It's piss compared to Puerto Rican brandy, Miss Izzy said from Joaquin's window.
Get out my window, Joaquin hissed angrily.
I'm making money for you, like before, rabbit head.
Get out my window and take the midnight broom out of town, hussy.
There was a fat glass ashtray at Miss Izzy's elbow. She grabbed it and tossed it at her ex-husband. It was a mild, casual toss, flung like a frisbee. She didn't even mean to strike him, and she didn't. Instead, the ashtray struck a pregnant woman in the shoulder. She was dancing near the front of the crowd with her boyfriend, and she quickly spun around and slapped Dominic, who was standing behind her holding the doll. Being a gentleman, Dominic raised his hand to stop her from striking him a second time, and inadvertently clunked the young mother's boyfriend on the head with a doll's hard battery head. In turn, the boyfriend reached his fist to whack Dominic, but instead his elbow struck Bum Bum in the jaw, who had stepped over to help the young mother. Bum Bum, furious at being hit, flung a pitch at her assailant and struck Sister G, who fell into Eleonora Soto, treasurer of the Cause House's Puerto Rican Statehood Society, who was sipping a cup of whiskey, which she spilled down the shirt of Calvin, the transit authority worker who had just given Sport Coat his $5 lunch money. And just like that, it was on. A fight, with biting, scratching, and kicking. It wasn't a free-for-all, but rather a series of skirmishes that exploded and quelled, breaking off here, starting again there, with referees and peacemakers scattered about, some taking knuckles in the face themselves, all on a hot morning when they should have been celebrating. Several fought till they got tired, sat down on the front steps in tears and exhaustion, and then, once they'd caught their breath, started up again just as enraged. Others cursed out one another until one or the other got struck by an errant fist, and then they too joined the fray. Still others fought silently, resolutely, in pairs, working out old grudges they'd held for years. They were all so busy that no one seemed to notice a tall figure in a black leather jacket. Bunch Moon's enforcer Earl, a switchblade knife in his fist, slowly working his way from the back of the crowd to the front, slipping left and right, easing towards Sport Coat, who was still seated on the front steps in front of Los Soñadores next to Soup, both of them watching the fight in wonder as the terrible band played on.
This is my fault, Soup admitted. I should have stayed upstairs and watched television.
Oh, the cotton and weeds comes together from time to time, but it ain't nothing, Sportcoat said. These things is good. They clears the air.
As he watched the scrambling, cursing mob, it occurred to Sportcoat that Joaquin's unopened bottle of delicious Dominican brandy, standing on the bottom step just a few feet away, looked lonesome, with nobody to keep it company. He also realized he'd have to get moving soon. He had to do some yard work for the old white lady over on Silver Street, who needed him in her garden planting. He usually went on Wednesday, but he'd missed last Wednesday because he'd promised to come today, Monday, and the old lady didn't fool around, which made him determined. He'd even decided to skip playing Joaquin's numbers that morning and head straight out to the old lady's house. But Joaquin's lousy band woke him up and derailed him. Now, he had to get moving. Still, seeing the lonely brandy by itself on the bottom step, he decided it wouldn't hurt to take a quick nip. Nothing wrong with getting a little daily relief before the job. He stood up and stepped down the stairs to grab the brandy on the bottom step. As he reached, someone kicked the bottle onto its back and it skidded onto the plaza and into the melee, unbroken, but spinning on its side, stopping a few feet away. He followed it, wading into the crowd. Just as he reached it, the bottle was kicked again and slid between the legs of Sister Billings and the young pregnant mother, the two still tangling as Dominic and the woman's boyfriend sought to separate them. He followed it, only to watch it get kicked again. This time it took a bouncing, flipping ride before sliding past the feet of Sausage and Calvin, the transit worker, slowing to a miraculous, agonizing, twirling stop between the legs of two women who were grappling with one another, each cursing and threatening to rip the other's wig off. The bottle spun round and round beneath their legs, slowly coming to a stop. Sportcoat crouched low, swiped it up, and was about to unscrew the lid when the bottle was suddenly swiped from his hand. "This is the white man's poison, Mr. Sportcoat," Soup said calmly, holding the bottle. "We don't need this stuff round here no more." He tossed the bottle casually over his shoulder, away from the crowd. Soup, as a kid baseball player, never had much of an arm. But as a giant, he had velocity. Several sets of eyes followed the bottle as it made a long, slow arc into the air, high up, twirling end over end, arching a bit as it reached its apex, then falling back to earth in a long, lazy, crazy, spiraling curve, boinking Earl, Bunch's hitman, right on the noggin. Amazingly, the bottle remained intact after pinging off Earl's head, then struck the pavement before finally smashing into pieces. Earl fell next to it, crumpling to the ground like a paper doll. The crash of the shattering glass and the sight of the fallen man stopped everyone. The crabbing and scratching ceased, and everyone hustled over, gathering around the prostrate Earl, who was out cold. In the distance, a police siren was heard.
"Now you all did it," Joaquin said gloomily.
Everyone realized the crisis instantly. Joaquin's apartment would be searched. He'd be closed for days, weeks, even months. That meant no numbers. Even worse, Soup was on probation. Any kind of trouble would put him back in the clink. What a mean world.
"Everybody get," Sister G said calmly. "I'll take care of this."
"I'll stay too," Dominic said. "It's my fault. I got Bum-Bum stirred up."
"Can't no man stir me up, Dominic Lafleur,"
Sister Billings snapped defensively.
"I don't need no man to stir my drink."
"That depends on the straw and the man," Dominic said, smiling. "I'm the Haitian sensation. Emphasis on sensation."
"Don't try that scallywag sweet talk on me, mister. I know you don't mean it."
Dominic shrugged as if to say,
What do I do now?
We're wasting time, Sister G said. She turned to the crowd. Get moving, y'all, she snapped. She turned to Calvin, the subway toll collector. Calvin, you and Soup stay. You too, Izzy. To the rest, she said, hurry up, y'all. Get. The crowd vanished. Most ran inside their buildings or hurried to work. But not everybody. Sport coat and hot sausage returned to the stoop, where Joaquin and Los Soñadores were hastily packing up. Sausage nodded at the band.
If they was the OJs, this wouldn't have happened, he said. Bongo music,
Sport coat agreed, shaking his head.
I never did favor it.
Is you gonna wait here to be arrested? Sausage asked.
I gotta get to work.
Let's get a snort before we set out, Hot Sausage said. I got some Kong in the workshop. We can take the back door and cut through the coal tunnel under Building 34. That'll put us back at 9.
I thought that coal tunnel was closed up.
Not if you the boiler man.
Sport coat grinned.
Doggone it. Use a good rooster, Sausage. Come on, then.
The two disappeared inside. Behind them, Sausage noticed Soup hoisting Earl over one shoulder and trotting out of the plaza. By the time the cops rolled up minutes later, the plaza was deserted. 20 minutes later, Earl came to and found himself on a bench on the platform of the Silver Street subway station. Seated on one side was the biggest Puerto Rican he'd ever seen, and on the other, a handsome black woman in a church hat. He felt his head. He'd been struck on the same spot where the errant baseball had hit him days before. He had a lump there the size of Milwaukee.
What happened?
He asked, his voice hoarse.
You was hit in the head with a bottle, the lady said.
Why's my clothes wet?
We doused you with water to get you up.
He felt in his pocket for his switchblade. It was gone. Then he noticed the handle of the folded knife poking out from the closed fist of the giant Puerto Rican, who had a face ugly enough to belong to a cadaver. His blade, Earl realized, wouldn't do shit on that Spanish elephant motherfucker but tickle him. Earl glanced nervously around the subway platform again. It was completely empty.
Where's everybody?
He asked.
We seen from your papers in your pocket. You was from Gates Avenue, out in Bed-Stuy, the woman said. So we is putting you on the train that way.
Earl started to curse, then glanced at the giant, who stared back at him, his eyes steady.
Seems to me, the woman began, you favors a preacher I once knew over in Bed-Stuy. Reverend Harris at Ebenezer Baptist. A nice man, the Reverend was. He died some years back. You any kin to him?
Earl was silent.
A good man, Reverend Harris was, she repeated. Worked all his life. Janitored over at Long Island University, I do believe. I recollects when my church visited Ebenezer that Reverend Harris had a child or two that favored you. Of course, this is going back a ways. I'm 48. I can't remember nothing no more.
Earl stayed silent.
Well, I do apologize for whatever misunderstandings you has had in the cause, she said. We seen from your wallet papers where you was from, and being God-fearing people, we brung you here so you could get home without no trouble from the police. We takes care of our visitors in the cause.
She paused a moment, then added,
we takes care of our own, too.
She let that one sit a moment, then got up. She nodded at the giant. Earl watched in awe as the stoic man, in a neat suit, bow tie, and crisp white shirt,
clearly a member, he realized now, of the feared and respected Nation of Islam, stood up. Up and up he went, unfolding like a human accordion, his giant fist still clasping the switchblade. When he stood up to his full height, his head nearly scraped the lights of the subway platform. The giant opened his big palm and, with two massive fingers, gently placed the blade on the bench next to Earl.
"Well, then, we bid you good day, son," the lady said. "God bless you."
She moved toward the stairs, followed by the lumbering giant. Earl, still seated on the bench, heard the rumble of an incoming train, and he looked down the tracks to see the graffiti-covered G train curving out of the tunnel toward him. When it stopped, he rose as quickly as he could manage, slipped gratefully aboard, and watched through the window as the woman and her giant, the only two souls on the platform, stood at the top of the stairs, watching the train roll out. He was the only passenger to board. He noticed there were no other passengers on the entire platform. The whole situation seemed odd. Only when the train moved did the two turn away. Sister G and Soup descended the stairs of the subway platform, then headed down an escalator that reached street level and the toll booth. When they arrived, Sister G noticed a crowd of about 15 impatient subway riders standing at all three entranceway turnstiles. All three were closed, each with an emergency cone blocking it. She glanced at the toll booth, and Calvin, the toll booth worker, quickly emerged and removed the cones without a word, then stepped back inside his booth. The subway riders rushed through the turnstiles and up the escalators. Sister G watched them mount the escalators in a hurry toward the train platform. When they were out of sight, she didn't turn away, but rather said softly to Soup, standing behind her, "Meet me outside, okay?" The big man lumbered toward the street exit as Sister G quickly crossed to the toll booth, where Calvin stood at the counter, his face stoic. "I owe you one, Calvin," she said softly.
"Forget it. What happened after everybody left?"
"Nothing. We hightailed over here by the back streets. Bum-Bum hid Joaquin's numbers in her bra. Miss Izzy told the police she and Joaquin had one of their fights. It's all good. Joaquin's back in business. The cops are gone. I can't thank you enough."
"If you put $2 on my number today, that'll square us," Calvin said.
"What number?"
143.
"That's a good sounding number. What's it mean?"
"Ask Soup," he said. "That's Soup's number."
She emerged from the Silver Street station and fell in beside Soup for the short walk back to the Cause houses.
"I reckon if your mama was alive, she wouldn't be pleased I put her son in a spot like this, cleaning up somebody else's mess. I don't know that I done right or not, but I couldn't carry that fella to the train myself."
Soup shrugged. "Course he was up to no good," she said. "I reckon he come here to do wrong to old sport coat. What's this world coming to if common church folk can't stand up for one of their own?" She thought for a moment. "I reckon I did right. On the other hand, sport coat's in a little too thick for my taste. You can get in deep water quick fooling around with them drug dealers. Don't you do it, Soup." Soup smiled sheepishly. He was so tall she had to squint to see his face in the afternoon sun.
"That ain't me, Sister G," he said.
"Why is Calvin playing your number? Is he in your new religion, too?"
"Nation of Islam."
"Not at all," Soup said.
"He and my ma was friends. We lived in the same building. He used to come by sometimes and watch my show with me.
The number's from that."
"What show is that?"
"Mr. Rogers."
You mean the nice little white man who sings with the puppets?
That's Mr. Rogers' address. 143. You know what 143 means?
No, Soup.
His stoic face folded into a smile.
I would tell you, but I don't want to spoil it.
Chapter 11. Pokeweed. 4 blocks from the Silver Street station, the elephant sat at his mother's kitchen table griping about a plant.
Pokeweed, he said to his mother. Didn't you say it was poisonous?
His mother, a diminutive olive-complexioned woman, was standing at the countertop, her gray hair in wild tousles about her head, slicing at several plants he had pulled out of her garden that morning. Fiddleheads, rootberry blossom, and skunk cabbage.
It's not poison, she said. Just the root. The shoots are good. They're good for the blood.
Get some blood thinners, he said.
Doctor's medicine is wasted money, she scoffed. Pokeweed cleans you out, and it's free. It grows near the harbor.
Don't plan on me digging around in the mud near the harbor today, Elefante grumbled. I gotta go to the Bronx.
He was going to see the governor.
Go ahead, his mother said defiantly. I got the colored man from the church coming by.
What colored man?
The deacon. That old scooch. The way he drinks, solid food makes a splash in his stomach when he eats it. You keep him out of the house.
Leave it alone, she snapped. He knows more about plants than anybody around here, she added.
More than you, that's for sure.
Just keep him outside.
Stop worrying. He's a deacon at the colored church there, the Four Ends or Deep Ends or whatever it's called.
5 Ends.
Well, he's there, a deacon.
She chopped away.
Elefante shrugged. He had no idea what deacons did. He remembered the old guy faintly as one of the coloreds who came and went from the church a block from his boxcar.
A drinker. Harmless. The church was on the far side of the street, while the boxcar was on the harbor side. Close as they were, separated by a weeded lot that ran the block's length, they were strangers to one another. But Elefante considered coloreds perfect neighbors. They minded their own business, never asked questions. That's the reason his guys pulled that poor lady from the harbor when she came floating into the dock a few years ago. He'd watch her come and go from the church for years, waving hello to him, and he waved back. That was the extent of their conversation, which in the cause, where the Italians and blacks lived side by side but rarely connected, was a lot. He never knew or heard the story of how she landed in the harbor. That wasn't his business. But he had a faint recollection she might be related to one or the other of the coloreds. He left his headman to keep up with details of folks like her. Not him. He didn't have time. He only knew that every Christmas since his guys pulled that lady out of the water, the church coloreds had dropped off 2 sweet potato pies and a cooked chicken outside his railroad boxcar. Why couldn't more people get along that way? He regarded his mother as she chopped. She had on his father's old construction boots, which meant she planned to go plant digging today, too. With the boots, the house dress, the apron, and her wild hair, she looked, he knew, like something from the outer limits. But at 89, she could do what she wanted. Still, he fretted about her health. He noticed the difficulty she had chopping. Her arthritic hands curled and gnarled. Rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, and a leaking heart were taking their toll. She had fallen several times in the past few weeks, and the doctor's murmurings about heart trouble were no longer murmurings. They were explicit warnings, outlined in red pen on her prescriptions, which she ignored, of course, in favor of the plants she swore fostered good health, or simply needed to be had for the sake of having them, the names of which he'd memorized from childhood. Black cherry, Hercules club, spice bush, and now, pokeweed. He watched as she struggled with the knife. He suspected the old colored gardener did all the chopping once he left. He could tell by the neat cut of the plants, their stems tied tightly with rubber bands, others with stems and roots cut just so. He was secretly glad she ignored his disapproval of allowing someone inside the house. Someone was better than no one. She was near the end. They both knew it. 3 months ago, she'd paid Joe Peck, whose family ran the last Italian funeral home in the Cause District, to send a man to disinter his dad's body over at Woodlawn Cemetery and bury it deeper. The overcrowded cemetery had no more space for new graves, so her plan was to be buried atop his father in the same plot. That required his father's casket to be reburied 8 feet down instead of the usual 6. Peck had assured her he had done the job himself. But the elephant was suspicious. Anything Joe Peck said could be a lie. "Did you get someone to sound that plot Joe Peck said he dug out?" he asked. "I told you already. I can take care of my business," she said.
"You know Joe says one thing and does another.
I'll get my colored man to check it.
He can't poke around a cemetery. He'll get arrested."
"He knows what to do."
Elefante gave up. At least there would be a set of eyes in the house while he ran up to the Bronx to check out the governor's tip. He sighed, rose from the kitchen table, reached for his tie on a nearby doorknob, placed it around his neck, and then stepped to the parlor mirror to tie it, feeling a blend of relief and, despite himself, a small bit of excitement. He'd already decided that the governor's story about this so-called hidden loot, this great treasure that his father had somehow hidden someplace in his boxcar or in his storage warehouse, was a fable. Yet a few discreet phone calls and a query to his mother proved that the governor's story was at least partly true. Elefante had confirmed that the governor had been his dad's sole friend and cellmate for 2 years in Sing Sing. His dad had also mentioned the governor to his mother several times as he drifted toward death, but she swore she'd paid little attention. "He said he was holding something for a friend, and it was in God's hands," she told him. "I paid it no mind." "Did he say, in God's hand, or the palm of his hand?" Elefante asked, remembering the poem the governor cited.
"You were there," she snapped. "Don't you remember?"
But Elefante did not. He had been 19, about to inherit a business that was beholden to the Gorvino family. His father was dying. He had to take over. There was a lot to think about. He was drowning in his own confused, bottled-up emotions at the time. God was the last thing on his mind.
"No, I don't," he said.
"He was talking out of his head at the end there," his mother said. "Papa hadn't been in church since he was out of prison, so I paid it no mind."
Elefante had checked all his storage places, the ones he had access to, which was more than he cared to let his customers know about, and come up empty. He raked through his own memories as well, but they played tricks on him. As a boy, he remembered his father saying to him several times, "Look out for the governor. He's got that crazy poem. Pay attention." But what teenager paid attention to his dad? His father didn't speak in detail anyway. He spoke in nods and grunts. Giving words to ideas was too dangerous in their world. When Papa did give words to something, though, it was for a reason. It had weight. So Papa must have been giving him a message. But what? The more Elefante considered the matter, the more confused he became. Driscoll Sturges, he decided, the governor himself, might have the answer, if there was one at all. So he'd called and made arrangements to see him, to maybe get some peace on the question. Elefante grabbed his jacket and car keys, feeling anxious and a little excited.
The trip to the Bronx was more of a break for him than anything else. He paused one last time at the mirror in the front hall to straighten his tie and unrumple his suit, checking himself out sideways. He still looked good. A little heavy, maybe, but his face was still tight, no wrinkles, no crow's feet around the eyes, no kids, no cousins he trusted, no wife who cared for him, no one to take care of his mother either, he thought bitterly. At 40, Elefante was lonely. Wouldn't it be nice, he thought, as he straightened his tie one last time, if there was a real big score in it? Just once, something that would get him off that pier, out of that hot boxcar, out of the squeeze between Joe Peck and the Gorvinos, who controlled every dock in Brooklyn, and get him to an island in the Bahamas where he could spend the rest of his life sipping grape and watching the ocean. The stress of the job was beginning to wear at him. The Gorvinos were losing faith in him. He knew it. He could tell they were increasingly irritated by his resistance to drugs, a prejudice he'd inherited from his father. But that had been a different time, and they were different men. The old man had kept the Gorvinos satisfied by renting them cheap storage space, doing quick under-the-table construction jobs for them, and moving anything they wanted outside of dope. But that was before, in the age of graft, numbers, smuggling, and booze. Dope was the thing now. Big money. And Joe Peck, the only other made member of the Gorvino family in the Cause District, had jumped into the dope game with both feet, becoming a major distributor, pulling Elefante in by the nose. There were plenty of docking points in Brooklyn, but Elefante was under constant pressure to keep his dock active because Peck was in his area, and Joe moved dope from water to shore in whatever stupid form he could dream up, in cement bags, in gasoline tanks, in the back of refrigerators, stuffed into TV sets, even in car parts. It was risky. He hated the whole tuna. Drugs were a damn stinking fish, the smell of it taking over everything. Gambling, construction, cigarettes, booze were all second rate now. Ironically, the Gorvinos weren't wild about dope, or Joe Peck either. They knew how stupid and impulsive Peck was, but they lived in Bensonhurst and not in the Cause. That might as well have been the moon as far as Elefante was concerned. They never got to see Joe's stupidity up close, which always complicated matters. Peck had his head so far up his ass he couldn't see the order of things. He made deals with the colored, the Spanish, and every two-bit crooked cop who could put two nickels together without one bit of trust between them. That was a recipe for disaster and a 10-year stretch in the workhouse. To make it worse, Victor Gorvino, head of the Gorvino family, was old as the hills and half-demented, fucked up in his head. Gorvino was under a lot of heat from the cops now. Getting in to see him to explain Joe Peck's stupidity was difficult. To top it off, Gorvino and Peck were Sicilian. The Elefantes were from Genoa, northern Italy, which fell right into his father's admonition. Remember, he'd remind his son, we're just a bunch of Genoans. They were always on the outside. When his father was alive, that difference between the northern and southern Italians didn't matter as much. His father and Gorvino were old school. They went back to the days of Murder, Inc., Brooklyn's enforcement arm of the mafia, where silence was the golden rule and cooperation was the key to a long life. But as far as Gorvino was concerned, the son was not the father. And now that Gorvino was half-cocked and not able to pull up his pants without help from his lieutenant, Vinny Tognarelli, a Gorvino underling Elefante didn't know well, the tight space that Elefante lived in had gotten even tighter. At the front door, he turned to his mother, who was still busy whacking away at the plants on her countertop,
and said in Italian, "What time is the colored coming?"
"He'll be here. He's always late."
"What's his name again?"
"Deacon something or other. They call him something else too, suit, jacket, or something."
Elefante nodded.
"What does a deacon do?"
he asked.
"How should I know?"
she said.
"They're probably like priests, but make less money."
Elefante exited the wrought iron fence surrounding his yard, stepped to his Lincoln at the curb, and had placed his key in the door when he heard the sound of Joe Peck's GTO turn the corner and roar up the street toward him. Elefante frowned as the GTO slowed and stopped as the passenger window rolled down.
"Take me with you, Tommy," Peck said.
Peck, seated in the driver's seat, was clad in his usual dark open-collared shirt and cleanly pressed pants, his handsome blonde features curled into his usual queer smile. The crazy pretty boy. Elefante ducked his head inside the car so the two couldn't be heard from the street.
"I'm going to mix business with business, Joe. No pleasure in it. You don't want to come.
Wherever you go, there's money in it."
"See you, Joe."
Elefante turned away and Peck called out,
"Give me a minute, will you, Tommy? It's important."
Elefante frowned and stuck his head inside the cab again, the two men's faces close together as the GTO rumbled.
"What?"
he said.
"Change of plans," Peck said.
"What plans? We going to the prom? We got no plans."
"About that shipment from Lebanon," Peck said.
Elefante felt the blood rush to his face.
"I already told you, I ain't doing that."
"Come on, Tommy," Peck pleaded. "I need you on this one, just this one."
"Get Herbie over in the watch houses. Or Ray out in Coney Island. Ray's got a whole crew now. He's got new trucks and everything. He'll take care of it for you."
"I can't use them. I don't like those guys."
"Why not? That's two guys. If you put them together, they'd make one man."
Peck's temples bulged and he grimaced, a look that Elefante knew spelled anger. That was Joe's problem, his temper. He'd known Joe Peck since high school. 3,000 kids at Bay Ridge High, and the only one stupid enough to pull out an X-Acto knife in auto shop and use it over a lost wrench was Joe Peck, the small, scrappy kid from the Cause District with a girly face and a brain the size of a full-grown pea. Elefante had been forced to beat Joe down himself 4 or 5 times at Bay Ridge High. But Peck had an amazingly short memory for losses. When he blew his top, he didn't care what happened, who was involved, or why. It made him a bold gangster, but a prime candidate to land in an urn in his own family's funeral parlor one day. Elefante was certain. Amazingly, the years had not mellowed him.
"The niggers at the Cause houses are crapping on my business," Peck said. "They shot a kid. Great kid, Negro. He turned over a lot of stuff for one of my customers. They say he's a real whiz kid. Just a great kid. Doing great. Till he got shot."
"If he's so great, why not give him one of those Negro scholarships, Joe?"
Peck's face flushed, and Elefante watched, half amused, as Peck beat back the rage, ignoring the insult.
"Thing is,"
Peck glanced through the front windshield, then through the rear one to make sure no one was nearby listening.
"The kid was shot by some old geezer. So my customer in Bed-Stuy sends one of his guys to even things out. He's tracking the old gunner to squeeze him. But the old bum don't want to get caught."
"Maybe he's a humble man who don't like attention."
"Can't you fucking listen for a minute?"
Elefante felt his pulse racing. He resisted the urge to reach across the seat, yank Peck out by his shirt collar, and part his pretty girly face with his fist.
"Get your blockers out of the backfield and get moving downfield, would you, Joe?"
"What?"
"Just tell me what you want. I got stuff to do."
"The guy they sent out to even things
He screwed up. The cops got hold of him. Now he's singing to the 7-6. A bird I know over there tells me the guy is singing like a robin, telling the cops everything. So before they cut him loose, this snitch tells the cops that my main colored customer, up in Bed-Stuy, wants to cut me out. The colors don't want me supplying them no more. How do you like that? Ungrateful niggas. I set them up, and now they want to double-cross me. They're going to start a race war.
Elefante listened in silence. This is what happens when you deal with people you don't trust, he thought bitterly. It doesn't matter if it's drugs or cereal. Same problem.
I ain't involved, he said. Gorvino won't like it.
Did you talk to him?
Yeah, well, not yet. I talked to his guy, Vincent. He says Gorvino will get back to me, but Bed-Stuy is our area. That's what Vincent says. He says we got to deal with it.
It's your area, Joe, not mine.
It's our dock.
But it's your dope. He saw Peck's face darken. He was fighting back his boiling temper, just a string away from busting loose. With great effort, Peck checked himself again.
Would you roll with me just this one time, Tommy? He said. Just this once, please. Move this Lebanon shipment for me and I won't ask you ever again. Just this one fucking time. With this one shipment, I'll make enough to muscle them niggas off and tell them to fuck off forever. And I can clean up things with Gorvino, too.
Clean up things.
I'm into him for a few thousand, Joe said, adding hastily. But I get this shipment, and I can clean that up easy, and I'm out of dope forever.
You're right, by the way. You've always been right about the dope. It's too risky. This is my last job. I'll clean things up, and I'm out of it.
Elefante stared at Peck in silence for a long moment. Come on, Tommy, Peck pleaded. For old time's sake. You haven't taken one goddamn shipment in 6 months. Not one. I'll give you $8,000. It'll take an hour. One fucking hour. Straight off a freighter, to the dock, and out. No one loading tires or nothing fancy. Just grab the stuff and get it to me. 1 hour. That's how long it'll take to get it out of your hair. 1 hour. You can't make that much slinging cigarettes in a month.
Elefante nervously tapped one hand on the car roof. The GTO rumbled, shaking, and Elefante felt his resolve shaking with it. Just an hour, he thought, to risk everything. It sounded easy. But then his mind ran through the scenario quickly. If the crap came in from Lebanon, it'd be on a freighter, probably out of Brazil or Turkey. That meant getting a fast boat to retrieve it, because a freighter would not dock in the cause. The waters were deep enough, but only barges came to Brooklyn, which meant probably taking a speedboat to the middle of the harbor from the Jersey side to be safe. That meant slipping past harbor patrol on that side, grabbing the loot in the middle of the harbor, racing back to shore, getting the stuff to an untraceable car that would likely have to be stolen, and then moving it to wherever Joe Peck wanted it. Knowing how the feds were everywhere now, it might be that Peck had the feds watching his front door and the Gorvino family watching the back door, since he owed the Gorvinos money. He didn't like it. Get Ray out of Coney Island. Peck's temper broke through. He banged the steering wheel furiously with his fist.
What kind of fucking friend are you?
Elefante's top teeth met the bottom of his folded lip as he felt the dreadful silence descend on him. The day, once hopeful and full of promise, with a pleasurable trip to the Bronx ahead to sound out a possible treasure, was ruined. Even if that so-called treasure was the pipe dream of an old Irish con artist who was likely full of shit, the idea of tracking it down to zero was still a reprieve from the day-to-day of his own trapped, screwed-up life. Now, the lightness of the day was gone. Instead, a familiar seething spread inside him, like a black oil slick, sliding into place. And the silence took over. It wasn't rage, uncontrolled and raw, but rather a cool anger that launched a terrible, unstoppable determination within him to squelch problems with the speed and dispatch that even the most hardened mobsters of the Gravino family found unsettling. His ma said it was the Genoan in him, because Genoans learned to live unhappily and trudged forward no matter what, just finishing things up, dealing with it, bearing up doggedly till the job was finished. The Genoans had been doing that, she said, ever since the ancient days of Caesar. He'd been to Genoa with his parents, and he'd seen it himself. A city of dull, exhausting hills, the dreary, ancient gray buildings, the solid stone walls, the bleak, cold weather, and miserable rain-soaked cobblestone and brick streets. The unhappy souls wandering about in tight circles, from home to work and back home again, grimly walking past one another, tight-lipped, pale, never smiling, marching stolidly down the small, drenched streets as the cold sea splashed over the sidewalks, and even over them, and them not noticing it. The smell of stinking sea and nearby fisheries climbing onto their clothing, into their miserable tiny houses, their drapes, and even into their food, the people ignoring it, plodding forward with grim determination like robots, having accepted their fate as unhappy sons of bitches living in the shadow of happy Nice, France, to the west, and under the sunshine disdain of their poor dark cousins to the south, Florence and Sicily, who laughed like dancing Negroes, happy and content to be the black Ethiopians of Europe, while their smiling cousins on the Mediterranean Sea, the French, sunned themselves topless on the lovely beaches of the Riviera. All the while, the hard-working, joyless Genoans marched on grimly, eating their fucking focaccia. No one appreciated Genoan focaccia except the Genoans. Best bread in the world, his father used to say. It's the cheese. Elefante tried it once and understood then why Genoans were a miserable lot. Because life was nothing compared to the delicious taste of Genoan food. Once they got to the food, the business of life, whatever that business was, loving, sleeping, standing at the bus stop, shoving each other at the grocery store, killing each other, had to be done with speed so as to get to the food. And they did it with such silent grit, such determination and speed, that to get in the way of it was like stepping into a hurricane. Christopher Columbus, his mother pointed out, was a Genoan who wasn't looking for America. He was looking for spices, for food. A real Genoan, she said, would hang themselves before they'd let anyone destroy the one or two things in life that gave them a little relief from the difficulties of the devil's world. Elefante found the whole business of his own anger frightening, because that's what his great furious silences were. Relief. A pressure cooker blown open. To his utter disgust, he'd found himself liking when the great silences came upon him. He hated himself later for those moments. He'd done some terrible things during those times. Many times afterward, in his darkest hours, in the late nights when Brooklyn slept and the harbor was dark, lying in bed in his lonely, empty brownstone with no wife and no children snoring in another room, with his widowed mother clomping around the house in her late husband's construction boots, the things he did during the spells when the silence came upon him tortured him with a searing brutality that caused him to sit up in the dark and check his pajamas for blood, feeling like his soul had been sliced into quarters, sweat bursting out of his pores and tears running down his face. But there was nothing to do then. The moment was over. The rage had already poured out of him like lava, unrelenting and merciless, steaming over whoever or whatever was in the way. And the sorry soul on the receiving end saw nothing more than a blank stare of cold clarity. Were they seeing the eyes of Tommy Elefante, the lonely man with the kind heart who ordered his obedient crew to pull poor old colored women out of the harbor, who had landed there for one reason or other, and why shouldn't they, since New York was shit? Or were they seeing the eyes of Tommy